This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not substitute for professional medical advice. Please seek a medical professional or healthcare provider if you're seeking any medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Thanks, everyone. All right.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Welcome back. My name's Evie.
I'm Julie.
And this is the Funny Medicine Podcast.
You let us know which one you like better, guys.
Yeah. Did we do a good job?
Was that good? Like, I don't know. There's so many people that are like, it's even on YouTube that they're like, we don't care.
Really?
Yeah. They're like, just do it. It doesn't matter. And I'm like, yeah. Oh, you guys are sweet.
I just feel bad for people that come into our podcast like new and they don't know who we are. We got to do it, guys. We have to introduce ourselves.
Yeah, no, we have to, of course. Anyway.
Anyways, so today we're talking a really good topic.
A big one.
And it's like a...
It's going to be a two-parter.
It's a two-parter, but I feel like it's going to be long for a three-parter.
Maybe. I mean, I separated the notes for two, but we will see what happens. Because it's just a monster of a topic of how much there is into it.
But I'm happy we're covering it. So much information.
Absolutely. It's like right now on...
I think a lot of people are going to like it too.
A lot of people are talking about it. You clearly see the title of it. It's autism.
Yeah.
So there's just so much information. It's so dense.
Autism is really dense.
Yeah.
I looked over the show notes. Jules is the one that usually does our... No, she's the one that does our show notes. She did such a good job on this.
I'm hoping. And it's just like there's so much new... things coming out too that it's
very
hard.
Complex.
Yeah, it's just it's hard to like because then that's the because autism like there's a lot of new treatments, a lot of new things, studies, and all these things that are coming out on it, like testing wise to see if it actually works or not, or if something's related to it or not.
Yeah.
So many things, but then there are also so many things that are false as well.
Yeah,
that are like overhyped or misinformation. So much misinformation in autism.
Yeah.
Which we will, there is a portion of this episode.
A little bit of like a debunking.
That we will talk about that in. But like.
I can't find a comfortable position.
We're still getting used to our new setup.
It's like hitting the microphone. I'm trying not to ruin
something.
Wall.
Do something like this. Like bring the microphone over here.
Yeah, a little bit. Just like. But I just feel like.
Yeah, that's why. Like, look at how mine is.
Yeah, like, why is your... Okay, there we go. Maybe
yeah, you
that.
See? Exactly. There okay. You go. There you go. So it's just more stationary there. We're trying to get used to all of this at the same time.
Yeah, I literally felt like I couldn't find a comfortable
Let position. Us know if you guys like this setup, too.
I know. Don't worry. This is going to come down
this
a little
gonna
bit.
This is going to come down. But, like, do you like us sitting here?
I kind of like this further? Better. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
I like this better. We kind of... If you've been following us for a while, you know how our show notes usually go. We're trying something a little bit more different. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I'm excited about this topic.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad that you are because it's a big and dense one. So we better be excited for this one.
Yeah, I think the reason why we hesitated a little bit on doing this.
Because there's so much misinformation.
Because there's a lot of misinformation and it could be really polarizing and super really political polarizing. For some reason.
Well, a lot of things in medicine are being politicized since
Which
COVID.
Which should not.
Should not. But for some reason, COVID really, really threw like
a wrench.
All of it. Like the whole political wrench into medicine. And it's like, can we not?
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a whole different topic. Anyway, it's autism. So what is it, Doc?
All right. I'm kind of just going to like read this off. Okay. So autism spectrum disorder is a lifelong neurodevelopmental condition that affects how a person perceives and interacts with the world. And I think that's beautifully stated. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, some individuals can have difficulty with social interactions, while others may have extraordinary skills in specific areas, like kids that or people that do math or science or just something. But anyways, it is a spectrum and we're going to talk all about that. I think Joel's can start us off a little bit on the history of it.
Oh yeah, I don't know where I put my thingy, like, you know.
Oh, the little tweak.
I don't know, I need to find it. Anyways, so as I typically do, here's a little bit about the history on it, because I mostly in this topic, it's one of the big things that people talk about, and that's why I kind of like emphasize the history. I went a little longer here. Don't worry, not too long. Because there's a lot of people that are, like, they harp on and they, like, really, really die on the hill of, like, but autism wasn't around before. Why is it now? Hold that thought.
Yeah, just hold that thought.
Hold that thought, because that's wrong.
Yeah.
But anyway, So autism has been around for a long time, but we just didn't have a name for it until the 20th century. Just a little quick timeline on how autism was just misunderstood, because that's really the problem with its history and why people harp on that so hard.
Yeah.
Because it was misunderstood.
Exactly.
And still to this day, it's a lot of it is misunderstood.
Misunderstood, yeah.
In the 18th and 19th century, some historical texts describe people who seem withdrawn, hyper-focused, and just had difficulty with what you would say, like, our social norms. Yeah. They kind of, like, describe those type of people. But back then, the medical world just didn't have the appropriate label for it, and they labeled them as eccentric, or this sounds bad, but this is how they labeled it, mentally deficient. Okay, so in 1943, someone called Leo Kanner, and he was an Austrian-American psychiatrist. He studied children who had trouble forming relationships. They displayed repetitive behaviors and had unusual speech patterns. He called it, quote unquote, early infantile autism. So yes, he's the one that quoted this, and he originally thought it only affected children, which obviously now we know that that's not the case.
And obviously this is in the 1940s. Let's put it into
1943. Yeah, 1943.
Yeah, so let's put it back into perspective. Medicine was not as it is nowadays.
Okay? Not even close. We had asylums.
Yeah, we had asylums. I mean, women with just like period symptoms.
Hysteria.
Like hysteria, exactly.
Yeah. Lobotomies.
Exactly. So this is the time that this was first brought up.
Exactly. Okay. In that environment.
Yeah.
All right. So 1944, Hans, I said it like the American that I am. Hans. Asperger, right?
Yeah. Okay. Asperger's. Well, okay. It's Asperger, yeah.
Okay. All right. So at least I didn't have to call that one into. Yeah. Anyway, so he was a Viennese doctor, described children with strong intellectual abilities, but difficulty with social skills. He called it autistic psychopathy. I almost had to call that one in, guys. Almost had to call it in. Okay. He was doing it for me.
Hans, I apologize. Yeah. No, we're good.
Psychopathy.
I'll handle it. What is that show? The one about the reporter or the journalist or something, and she dates the president. It's also Shonda Rhimes.
Oh, Scandal.
Scandal. What's her name?
Olivia Pope.
Exactly. Consider it handled. She was always her thing. Anyways, okay.
100%. Okay, so him. So he, the autistic psychopath.
Now I'm questioning myself. Psychopathy.
There we go. This later became known as Asperger's syndrome, though we no longer use that term.
Yeah.
So from the 1960s to the 70s, the refrigerator mom theory.
I know.
I couldn't believe this one when I found this one. But listen to this, guys. So this is the environment that we're talking about, all right? So this is why it wasn't very...
It's a mom's fault.
Yeah. Psychologists blamed autism on quote unquote cold, unloving mothers. This later was debunked, obviously, but imagine the damage that that did to families.
And imagine the moms, like cold, unloving moms. These are probably what I can picture is these moms that probably have like 5 or 6 kids.
Right.
Take care of everything,
right.
The stay-at-home mom and everything.
Back then.
Probably has some sort of depression, anxiety.
Yep.
Right? And this was the refrigerator.
And then to boot, it's like, oh, your child is behaving this way because of you.
Yeah. You're a refrigerator mom.
What the... Anyway.
Yeah.
So, guys, this further cements why this wasn't brought up before. Why wasn't it this common? Guys, this is the environment that it was before.
Yeah.
We're calling refrigerator moms.
Yeah, exactly. Not anything else. No. Moms.
So in the 1980s, the DSM-3, we're now up to 5, okay?
Yeah.
Autism was officially recognized as a disorder in the medical manual DSM-3. Over the years, the definition expanded, leading to the concept of the autism spectrum.
It's autism itself. Okay.
Yeah.
Has really, diagnosis wise, has only been around for like 40-ish years.
Exactly. So since 1980.
Okay. Yes. So we are learning so much.
Exactly.
Because we officially, just the name, we officially got it finally to be recognized mm-hmm. in the DSM mm-hmm. as that in the 80s.
Exactly. So how were you going to diagnose it before it was even diagnosable?
Yeah, exactly. You know? So this is already for everyone to kind of like start thinking about, well, why is it that there's so much autism now and everything? We actually started being able to diagnose it mm-hmm. just in 1980.
And it was okay. 1980.
Yes. And again, because it came onto the DSM, right? The DSM mm-hmm. criteria. Doesn't mean that people were like, oh, yeah, let's start diagnosing it. No, this is something that started getting recognized little by little. Mm-hmm. And that's usually how things work. We come up with it and then we start doing research on it. And then we start doing therapies. We are able to like collectively grow and learn from these things. Okay.
And it was 1980.
Yeah, 1980. Exactly.
Okay. So 1980 is very different from today.
Yeah.
In many forms, social norms, many, many things, you know? Yeah. And then, so today, autism awareness and acceptance. Autism is now recognized as a neurodevelopmental condition with genetic and neurological roots, not a disease, not bad parenting, and definitely not caused by vaccines. If you believe that, I don't think this is the...
You should probably...
I don't think this is a podcast for you. Yeah. As a whole. Not even the episode.
Exactly. Like, we might not be the ladies for you.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but we believe in vaccines here. So it's not even like, oh, this might not be the episode for you. No, this might not be the podcast for you if you are an anti-vaxxer. I'm sorry. And a really, really good podcast, because I know things could get dense, like in the vaccine world and whatever to read on it. But another really good podcast that I always believed in vaccines. I always knew about it. I've been in the science world forever.
It's just not vaccines. It's just medicine.
Exactly.
And preventative medicine.
But Science Versus, that podcast, did, I think it was a multi-parter on vaccines. Incredibly done.
Yeah.
Incredibly done. Very well said. Very easy to understand. Great examples.
Great examples.
And then even like interviews with people that used to be anti-vaxxers and then started learning more about it and then realized, hey, I was like misinformed or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. So check that out. That could give you a really good like basis to a lot of things that maybe that we are saying or just the environment as a whole and what's happening these days with vaccines as a whole.
All right. So let's get a little bit into why it's called spectrum. Autism isn't just like a one size fits all diagnosis. Some people need significant support while others function independently, but still experience social or sensory challenges. That, again, it's a spectrum, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Just because you have one thing doesn't mean that you have autism.
Right.
And just because you have the other thing doesn't mean that you don't have autism. Mm-hmm. So it is a spectrum. And sometimes I feel like in the media and maybe back then, certain criteria, like let's just say like the hand flapping. Okay.
Yeah.
Because that is one that is very
prominent.
Very prominent. However, I think about probably how many kids have been missed in the diagnosis of autism just because they don't have hand flapping. You know what I mean?
That's why it's hard.
It's hard. It's really hard. Yeah. And that's why it is a spectrum. Mm-hmm. Okay. So just because you don't have the hand flapping movements and all these things doesn't mean that you don't have autism.
I think the other big one too, the other like common one is making eye contact.
The poor eye contact, yeah.
Yeah, that's another one that I know of that's pretty common. I mean, we'll get more into it, but like those are things that it's like just because you don't meet one doesn't mean that.
Yeah, you might not meet the criteria as mm-hmm. a whole. But anyways, okay, so let's talk a little bit of like the common areas that are affected by autism. I keep on looking at here when it's there.
I know. That's why I made it small, because
if not, we're going to be drawn. But we're so used to looking at ourselves here because the camera's always like sitting on top.
Do you want me to do this?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about first social communication.
Yeah.
Obviously, with autism, they tend to be it's very difficult for them to have a social interaction. This is going to be the eye contact. This is going to be the kid that doesn't want to play with the other kids. Mm-hmm. Or at home, what kind of interaction does that person have at home? It's just picking up on social cues that might be really difficult for someone that has this. Repetitive behaviors. This is the one that we were kind of talking about, like the hand flapping movements. It's not just hand flapping, though. Usually, I try to kind of ask about it in a different way. So, for example, I don't ask specifically, well, do they do weird, like, hand movements in front of their face? I usually ask the parents, well, when they're upset, what do they do? Or do they have a behavior that makes them feel better? Or do they have a type of behavior that they do real often and is usually triggered by an emotion? So those are kind of like the repetitive behaviors. Now, sensory sensitivities is really common as well. So loud noises can be a big trigger.
Yes, yes.
And that is one that I feel a lot of parents come to me and they say, when I turn on the vacuum, my kid goes crazy. And I mean, turn on the vacuum in front of me and I'm going to go crazy too.
Me too.
Like,
me too.
I can't stand having the oven fan, the that bell. What is that called?
Yeah, the extractor fan.
The extractor, exactly. Oh, we call it la campana in Spanish, but it's like a bell. But anyways, I cannot stand
and then
that
how,
thing on.
How much of a relief is it when you turn it
when
off?
You turn it off. You're like, that's what was wrong with my life. Oh, that was wrong.
God, like the whole time, just yesterday cooking, I was like, and then I turned it off and I'm like,
Exactly.
Why did we have to make these things so loud?
So loud. Exactly.
We're in 2025. Come on, people.
So now, obviously, yes, there are times that specific noises are going to trigger some sort of anxiety for someone. So that's what we're trying to say here. But also other sensory things could be food, different textures of foods, colors of food, smells of food, temperatures of food. Right. That's why a lot of kids with autism tend to have really picky eating habits because they feel extremely uncomfortable anything outside of what that normal texture is to them.
It could be that they're so in tune and like their senses, exactly. Their senses are so hyper, like focused, hypersensitive that that's why it's like something as just temperature is just.
And sometimes it's not even about loud noises. You know, sometimes they'll walk around with earmuffs because it's just
too much
going on in the world.
And how many of us have actually felt that?
Yeah.
Without being like diagnosed as autistic.
Exactly.
Like I have felt that. Like when when I lived in New York, a subway. Oh my God. Going into a freaking subway tunnel at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Forget it. I immediately was just like, noise canceling earphones. Here we go.
Exactly.
Too much.
So now, all of that is just like the common areas where autism tends to have those signs that we maybe raise a red flag for. Now, really, autism is kind of just describes a group of neurodevelopmental conditions that share these features, right? So those features that we just talked about. But over time, really, the spectrum kind of evolved. And again, this is something that started having a name in 1980.
Yeah.
So over time, we've been able to really learn a lot about it.
And it's something so, it's not like, just because we just finished doing an episode on something related to that, Bell Gibson. It's not like cancer.
Yeah.
That it's tangible.
Yeah.
It's tangible. It's observable.
Yeah.
Like you could actually look at scans. You could surgically manipulate cancers, treat it physically. Like it's a physical thing. Autism is very abstract. It's very abstract. It's neuro and it's behavioral. So it all is very dependent on the patient. It's very variable. There's a lot of variability to it.
And can affect a person living day to day.
100%.
It affects their learning, their interactions with people, their relationships, everything.
Of course. So that's why it's so much harder to diagnose, to study, to put on like black and white paper, hey, this is something that is under autism, because it's literally just by observation, not by something tangible, not by something that you could touch, grasp, look at in a screen. That's why I like that that argument. And I'm just saying that because I've gotten that argument with like friends and like just people of like, but it wasn't as common before. I'm like,
one, because it probably was not diagnosed before.
Exactly. It couldn't. It wasn't named before, it wasn't diagnosable before the 80s.
How many parents were just like the weird kid? You know what I mean?
And it's dark, but it's true. Back then in the freaking 20s, when there were mental asylums,
yeah,
they would just stick anybody in there.
In there, yeah.
anyone, even women with bad periods.
Yes.
They would take them to asylums.
Yes.
So imagine these misdiagnosed, misunderstood people.
Misunderstood, yeah.
You know, that had autism, but they just didn't have a label for
it. And not only that, but because they didn't have that diagnosis, remember, if you don't put like a diagnosis on something, a name on something, we can't do much with it, right? Because it's like, what are we talking about? You know, we finally gave it a name. We finally gave it the attention that it needs. And because of all these efforts and people that dedicate their lives to understanding more is why we have the therapies that we have today, why we have the advancements that we have today, the gene testing that we have for it today, the research that we have for it today. Now it's like we finally have dedicated a lot of our resources to figuring out how we can best treat or how can we best take care of these people with autism. And it's not just kids, it's adults.
Exactly.
I can't tell you the amount of times that I've had like families and friends and just acquaintances that tell me, well, yeah, such so-and-so was actually diagnosed like later in life. Same as ADHD, that they were, they never got diagnosed when they were little, when they were kids.
Yep.
They only got diagnosed when they were older.
Exactly. And that's the thing. There's a lot of adults out there that have, that they land somewhere in the autism spectrum and they just never got diagnosed.
Yeah.
They never did. And for many reasons, for social reasons or for just not doing it.
Yeah. And then literally today, right? Mm-hmm. So as of like when Julie did the show notes, as of February 19, we're going to talk about like the simple breakdown, okay, of like all these neurodevelopmental disorders that are under the umbrella of autism spectrum.
Right.
Okay. Starting off in 2013, the DSM-5 manual combines several different conditions that would land under this spectrum. So it's going to be different diagnoses. I guess that's like the best like categories, right? But that all fall under this umbrella.
Right.
So one is going to be the classic autism, which is autistic disorder. What that's going to look like is going to be the trouble with social skills, making relationships, or being able to communicate with other people, delayed talking, or maybe not talking at all, okay? And that can happen. It's often noticed in early childhood, obviously, because you start seeing that they're not talking as much, or maybe they were, and then they kind of stopped.
They're not meeting the same milestones.
Exactly. They're
not meeting. And you're a pediatrician. You know those. What are the, like, those milestones or whatnot?
Yeah, so usually we have different milestones, and we kind of have a general idea of what you're supposed to be doing at specific, like, age that you hit, right? And I have had parents tell me, well, I believe that kids develop at their own time. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that the two-year-old has to have exactly 200 words in their vocabulary, right? That could really vary, okay? Uh-huh. However, if you're telling me that your two-year-old only says mom and dad, I will say I think that that is a delay.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
So that is what I'm, you know, like...
Like an example of the
milestones. An example of the milestones, okay?
Right.
And yes, absolutely. Every kid develops differently. How many times did I see that a kid where I thought had a developmental delay in their language started school and all of a sudden was a parent and they did not stop?
Yep.
Okay?
That happened with my kiddo.
Yeah. So
that's exactly what happened with my kiddo.
Yeah. And, you know, and again, not to say that just if your kid has like a developmental language delay that they should start, you know, start school, you know, because I have like a lot of parents that they're like, well, I want to wait and I want to start school first because, you know, usually they let go. Yeah, absolutely. Because now they're forced to communicate, right? And they're also looking at other people communicating with each other, other kids laughing and playing and talking.
Right.
So they're obviously going to somewhat try to mimic
exactly
that, right? But however, early intervention is the main topic. And but anyways, that's a whole entire other subject.
Right, right, right.
Okay, so that was classic autism. Then you have Asperger's, which we don't really use
anymore. Well, you don't use Asperger's anymore, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. However, but this is like one of those that fell into that, okay? So basically, this is what I would call the high-functioning autism. Good at talking, okay? Sometimes really chatty about specific things, but however, will kind of struggle a little bit socially. Again, really good at something, a very specific thing, but doesn't like to really move outside of that comfort zone for them. And some of these kids are, or the kids that used to be Asperger's, are like the ones that are like in regular classes, right, and they don't need extra therapies or anything. However, it's really hard for parents to get them out and be a little bit more like extrovert.
Yeah, social. Okay.
Social, yeah. Exactly. So that's, it's kind of like a milder form. Then you have the pervasive developmental disorder that's not otherwise specified. This is a little bit of a catch-all. Maybe has some traits of your classic autism. Maybe has some traits of an Asperger's.
Mm-hmm. I can see how this could be more related to adults.
I actually see this a lot for like when kids, it's just really not clear. When it's too early to tell.
Okay, yeah.
So a lot of practitioners will diagnose pervasive developmental disorder when we don't want to give it a name yet.
Right.
You know, I truly don't know. And that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay to say that. Right. However, it does mean that we're thinking, but we're not just sure yet. Yeah. Like, we don't want to put that name. However, we will believe that that person would benefit from certain treatments that might be similar to those with already a diagnosis. Right.
Therapies, okay, considerations, yeah, things like that. Yeah,
exactly.
Makes sense.
And then you also have childhood disintegrative disorder. This is pretty rare. These are like the kids that like develop like super normally and then all of a sudden regress, okay, or stop completely and then regress backwards.
Okay.
It's really rare. However, those I associated with other things, which is what we're going to talk about now, something like Rett syndrome. So Rett syndrome, it used to be, and I remember this. I remember like when I would study, it's so crazy, like how much I studied my books that I remember how things were like categorized, like tables. I have like vivid like pictures
so
of tables.
So you have a photographic memory?
No, I do. I have like a photographic memory.
Okay.
I might not remember your name, but I remember your face. And no, and sometimes parents are like, oh, wow, you remember all of that? And then I'm like, I pick up a lot of things from like photographic memory. But anyways, so this was kind of linked to autism before because it usually involved like, let's just say a typical presentation would be a four-year-old girl that was talking full sentences and all of this. And then all of a sudden just stops doing what she used to do before. And then it's just like going backwards.
Wow. Okay.
So this was like kind of grouped with autism. However, now it's actually associated with a specific gene. That's the MECP2 gene. So they kind of took it out of that umbrella from autism.
But you see how this is a great example of how these things are just like we're further learning about it now. There's no way we would have learned about this in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that it was a gene.
Exactly.
So, and that was just the 80s.
Yep. And then before, ADHD, intellectual disability, like this was all kind of under that same autism umbrella. And it's not like now we can see that that's something completely different. That doesn't mean that it cannot coexist. Right. That's another thing.
Yes, yes.
There are many children and people that are diagnosed with autism and ADHD, which all goes to show that these are two completely different things that can coexist together. It's not one or the other. So the whole entire spectrum concept, it came about because experts like really realized that these conditions are not just like separate boxes. It could overlap a lot. And that's what like medicine is. It's not black and white. It can be pretty gray sometimes. And it doesn't have to be one thing or the other. It could truly be two things at a time or three or four. So some people need a lot of help, like with doing regular things, like their activities of daily living. So dressing themselves, feeding themselves, bathing themselves. And then some people can actually be able to manage on their own, go through school normally, no therapies, go to college, have a job, do all those things. And that's why we decided to not just say autism disorder. That's why it wasn't just Asperger's. Now we truly call it an autism spectrum disorder because
there's so much variability
from person to person. The DSM-5 rates autism spectrum disorder by levels as well. Level 1, 2, or 3, just kind of based on how much support that you need. Mm. Obviously, more severe cases need more support.
Yeah.
And rather than just like kind of splitting them into labels, I go along like with this. This is just better. It continues to say it's a spectrum and we grade it by how much help that you need.
Okay. Right. Makes sense.
As of 2025, there's no real crazy shakeups going on in the whole entire ASD world or the DSM-5.
When it comes to diagnosing.
Yeah, when it comes to like diagnosis, there hasn't been any interruptions in that or new things.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are a lot more gene testing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we will talk about that.
Yeah, so like rare genetic disorders, let's just say Fragile X, or that could be closely tied to autism, but nothing has really been added just yet as of 2025. I mean, we just...
Now, February of 2025.
Exactly. So autism spectrum today officially covers 4 old diagnoses. So again, the autistic disorder, Asperger's, pervasive developmental disorder, and it's all blended into this spectrum, this umbrella. Okay. And again, it can vary from person to person.
Yeah. Which is, again, why it's hard and why it's hard to diagnose, period.
Yeah.
You know,
it's very difficult. Yeah,
it's very difficult. Like I said, it's not cut and dry. It's not something that's easily observable in black and white or in photos or in pictures or in scans
and blood work. And still till this day, I still feel that it is really hard to diagnose this because everything is still so categorized. I wish that there was more support, more centers, right? Centers where everything is multidisciplinary. Mm. So I can meet when we come with the patient, like we can all overview kind of debrief the patient. But I can talk to the speech therapist. I can talk to the physical therapist. I can talk to the developmental specialist, whether that's a neurologist, whether that's a pediatric developmentalist, whether that's a psychiatrist. But, you know, a multi-specialty approach so that we can all kind of get a better understanding of what that person needs.
Yeah.
Instead of just, I can't tell you how many times it's like, you know, I feel terrible, but the parents or the person is kind of like relaying information. Well, my speech therapist doesn't really think that this is this, but my neurologist says that it is this. And it's hard.
Yeah,
it's really hard when there's so many moving pieces and you can't really get everyone together to really provide a proper assessment.
And then if it comes down to the parent being the one, we're just using kids as an example because she's a pediatrician, so it's hard to like for then the parent to be the center of all of this information falling into the parent when the parent is already very emotionally tied and invested into this child. So instead of it falling onto a specialist or just a doctor, like a general doctor, call it family, call it peds, call it whatever it is, falling out to somebody that could actually decipher all of this information that's coming from all these specialties, from all these different avenues into something more, something more like digestible.
Yeah.
You know, because the parent at the end of the day might just be playing like a game of telephone.
Exactly.
Because they don't really understand, like they're just too emotionally invested. They don't really understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these things are hard to understand.
Yeah, I know.
You know, so... Now, what causes autism, all right? Why did I think this was a good thing for us to talk about? It's because it's very prevalent in today's society, environment, what have you. People, and that makes sense, right? Because biologically and just like how the human psyche works, we want to find reasons. We like to ask why. And if you have a kid, if you've been a parent, you know that the question why comes very early. It's just part of human nature. We want to know the reason why things happen or why things are the way they are. So I get it why that's become like such a trending topic these days of, oh, but why does autism happen? All right. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about it in a science-based type of
conversation. Yeah,
exactly. So autism is not caused by a single factor, at least by what we know of as of today. It's a combination of genetics,
brain development, and some environmental factors even. Let's talk about a little bit about the genetic side of it. What's the DNA connection with autism? So one of the strongest scientific findings about autism is that it has a significant genetic component. And that's something that we learned recently. That definitely, we didn't know that in the 80s.
Yeah, no, yeah, that we didn't know in the 80s. But absolutely. I always like give this example. I have patients that they are multiple siblings, mm-hmm. multiple siblings, and they are all autistic.
There you go. And she's a pediatrician for, if you guys didn't know.
Yeah. So they are all diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. So you cannot tell me that there's not something hereditary in there, or it's like hard. Genetic, I should say.
Exactly. Because the probabilities of that would be against you. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. yeah. If you're talking like statistics and whatnot, but it's not as simple as inheriting one autism gene. So instead, autism is highly polygenic, meaning that the multiple genes contribute to its development, right? That's why it's still, as of today, February 2025, as we're recording this today, there isn't a marked, like you could take a blood sample or collect DNA from you and however you can and be like, well, you have an autistic gene. Mm-hmm. We haven't gotten to that level, maybe, and hopefully we do. But as of right now, there isn't. It's just like several genes can contribute to something along those lines. Mm-hmm. Some key findings from genetic research as of late. First one, twin studies. The strongest proof for genetic influence comes down to these twin studies, right? So identical twins who share 100% of their DNA, in essence, they have 90% chance of both being autistic if one is diagnosed.
Yeah.
That's kind of like a very big
link.
Yeah. For
whenever we do these studies, I mean, you can't get better than twin studies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially identical twins.
Exactly. Exactly.
So.
Then you got fraternal twins, right? So identical twins are identical. And that, what was this? Okay. So I always get these confused. So identical twins come from the same sac, right?
Yeah. Same egg.
Same egg.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the fraternal is different eggs. Mm-hmm. Different eggs. So, and different sperm, because if you have different eggs,
exactly.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's two different, but they're in the same time.
Yeah.
Okay. There we go. So I just explained to you the difference.
Yeah.
So fraternal twins, they share 50% of their DNA like regular siblings, because like we just discussed, different eggs, different sperm, but just at the same time, who have 30 to 50% chance of both being autistic. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's pretty high. When we're talking about like medical statistics, that's pretty high. This shows that genes are a major factor, but not the only factor.
Yeah.
Then next up, you have over 100 plus genes linked to autism. Scientists have identified hundreds of genes associated with autism, but no single gene that quote unquote causes autism on its own as of yet. Instead, a combination of genetic variations can increase the likelihood of autism. Some well-known autism-related genes include the, all in caps, SHANK3, which plays a role in brain connectivity and is linked to some forms of severe autism. Then you have CHD8, which regulates brain development and is associated with both autism and intellectual disability. Next up, you have NRXN1 and LGN3, which affect synapse formation.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah. And all these genes are like really hard to say because they're all like abbreviations and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And you see how difficult this could all like get, it's just, and this is me trying to break it down for you guys. Like I'm really, really like breaking it down as much as I possibly can. Like we're trying to explain this as simply as we can, but these are just genes that can contribute to it. And then how do these genes affect the brain? So synaptic function, which is like how neurons just communicate with each other in the brain. And then brain connectivity. Autistic individuals often have unique neural wiring, with some brain regions showing over-connectivity and others showing under-connectivity. So another reason why this is like really hard to just like pinpoint. And then you have neurotransmitters. There's differences in dopamine, serotonin, and even GABA, which are chemicals that like regulate your mood and behavior. Like some of these, like I believe it's dopamine that make you feel good and all that. It's like the feel good hormone. And these are often found in autistic individuals to be like just different in levels. Then lastly, you have spontaneous or de novo mutations. So not all cases of autism is inherited.
Yeah.
Some children with autism have de novo mutations, which means that they occur spontaneously in the sperm or egg before conception. These genetic changes aren't found in their parents even. So this is just completely spontaneous. And then lastly, autism and family history. If you have an autistic sibling, your chances of being autistic are 20 times higher than someone without an autistic sibling. So that even comes, I mean, 20 times is high.
It is.
If you have autistic parents, the likelihood of autism in offspring is significantly higher. And then other neurodivergent traits like ADHD, dyslexia, OCD also run in families with autism, suggesting a shared genetic basis.
Yeah, this is huge, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's family history. And I can't stress enough how important family history is. And it's sometimes one of the things that people like mostly forget. It's what is your family history? And sometimes it's mostly the one that people don't know.
That's what I was going to say. A lot of them don't even know it.
Yeah.
Or they don't even consider it. Oh, yeah, I do have, like, my mom was a little crazy about the way that we alphabetized the cans or something, you know? It's like OCD.
Sorry. I don't mean to.
No, sorry. No, it's fine. So, you know, there's things that people just put under the rug because of just social norms, especially before.
Yeah.
Back then. Like, just when we were kids, we're 35. So just when we were kids, I could definitely see how, like, things were definitely swept under the rug for many people. Yeah. They didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to look quote unquote weird.
Weird, yeah.
So then imagine that, how hard it is then to collect an accurate family history if a lot of things are not even addressed.
Yeah.
You know?
I know. All right. So I think this next section is going to be like pretty big. And I think it's one of the hardest to measure or test because it could just be so variable.
But it's very up and coming.
But it's very up and coming.
Like they're paying more attention to it now than before.
Yes. So environmental factors. Well, how does this play into autism? Science as a whole is like really exploring a lot of different things that could potentially be linked to autism. And one of these things can be pretty big is prenatal factors. So any infections while you were pregnant, any toxins that you ingested when you were pregnant, during the birth, was there any trauma? Was there any like oxygen deprivation to the baby? But doesn't mean that it causes it, right? This is basically going from person to person to person to person. Look at how it needs to work. This person needs to give birth, okay? Then later on, let's just say 4 to 5 years later, when you're having this conversation that you have a concern for autism spectrum disorder, then these people have to think back on 4 or 5 years. So this is how hard it is to remember everything. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine being asked like, do you remember when you were pregnant with MR, what you ate? Did you have any? You see? So that's
you're already dealing with pregnancy as a whole.
Exactly. You know,
it's like, oh, yeah. Of course.
So all these specific questions. And
that's the problem with retrospective studies.
Yeah.
And autism, unfortunately, when you're trying to find the why in it, is retrospective.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And then obviously there's other things, part of the environmental, which is like the vaccines, right?
Here we go.
We're going to go into it. So myth busting, vaccines do not cause autism.
Period.
That's it. There is no paper indicating links between vaccines and autism.
And we're going to go into the one paper.
The one paper that was literally taken out.
Redacted. No longer exists.
Okay. And I tried looking for it.
I know.
I'm sure I can find it if I really like put my mind to it.
I'm sure that somebody saved it somewhere or whatever and then later on scanned it and uploaded because that's how old it is too. I mean, but anyway, we will go into more depth into that catastrophe that it was.
Yeah. But unfortunately, it is the myth that doesn't die.
It is, because he's still out there.
Yes, he's still out there and he's still getting paid for all his things. So let's talk about one of the greatest autism hoaxes on vaccines.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go into it.
So it was basically a fraudulent study, and let's call it what it is. It was fraud. And it pretty much fueled a global health crisis globally. And then it was one of the biggest medical myths of modern times that basically claimed that vaccines caused autism. So it was a false belief And this person, his name was Andrew Wakefield. And he was a doctor. Now he's no longer a doctor.
Yeah, they even stripped him away from his medical license.
Exactly. Good. That's what you deserve. But still, he doesn't need to be a doctor anymore. He can make
people
money.
People still seek him out.
Exactly. Basically, he created numbers and falsified a bunch of information. But he basically came out with a paper that unfortunately was published on The Lancet, which is a
huge
publisher for medical articles and new research and new discoveries.
It's like the New England Journal of Medicine.
Yeah, like a New England Journal of Medicine, BMJ. The Lancet, you know, it's JAMA. A big place. Yeah,
it's JAMA. Like up there. Yeah. In those big ones.
Now, let's break down the information. So basically, it was all based on a study that came out in 1998. Let's talk a little bit about Wakefield, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not even going to call him doctor. Andrew Wakefield, he was a British gastroenterologist. So he had nothing to do with virology. He was not a researcher. He was nothing. He was a gastroenterologist. That's not nothing. I didn't mean to like shit on gastroenterologists.
But in relation to
what we're talking about. Remember, this is all perspective. In relation to what he's saying, he was a gastroenterologist. Okay. Yeah. And maybe if you told me he was a gastroenterologist that worked a lot in like fields of like vaccines and stuff like
virology.
He actually did some really, really weird shit. So anyways, he worked at the Royal Free Hospital in London. And then before 1998, he had no particular expertise in vaccines or autism.
Awesome.
So that was before 1998. Did not have anything, like nothing in vaccines. No other research in vaccinations. No other research in autism. Nothing. And then he randomly came up with a study.
Go into it.
Yeah. All right. So basically, he became very interested. All of a sudden, he had this huge interest on gastrointestinal issues, okay, mm-hmm. in children with autism.
Oh my God. Like so random. Like why? You know?
Yeah. Mm. Like a random, okay?
Oh my God. So random.
So in February 1998, he published a small study. And when I say a small study, I mean a real small study, okay?
This is not
in The Lancet. Again, one of these things that I'm just like, oh, how did this get published? But anyways, in The Lancet, a really prestigious medical journal, and this study would later become pretty much one of the most infamous papers that The Lancet ever published, okay? And I bet that they're kicking themselves for doing that. Now, what did the study claim? So let's talk a little bit about that study. In basic terms, it was a study of 12 children. That's it.
12.
That is it. That the whole entire vaccine hesitancy and everything came off of a study of 12 kids. I'm not saying that one kid is not important. I'm just saying for such a strong accusation, it was based off a study of 12 people.
And there's more to that, who these 12 kids are. But in today's standards, 12 kids is 12 individuals, 12 humans.
Yeah.
In a study that big, became that big, is insignificant in today's standards.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's laughable.
Yep.
Like, it wouldn't.
Yep. So this 12-child study, it was basically 12 kids that were experiencing gastrointestinal issues and also developmental delays. Now, the study suggested that the MMR vaccine, which is the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, was linked to a gut inflammation, which he himself coined an autistic enterocolitis. Okay. Now, that gut inflammation was somehow linked to autism.
Somehow.
And that the parents... Not explained. And the parents, 8 out of the 12 children in the study, believed that autism symptoms began shortly after their vaccination. So those 12 kids, only 8 of the parents were actually the ones that believed that all of this started after the vaccinations.
Mind you, the vaccinations happen in a schedule of where you could actually start observing some traits that are defined as autistic.
Yeah.
Okay. That's another part of the coin.
Yeah.
Before that, you can't really...
But that's like two things that exist separately, right? So,
but they feed off of it.
Exactly.
Like,
so you know, the reason why we screen for autism at around 18 months to 2 years is because anything before is, it's too early.
If you have a newborn, if you've had a child, you get it.
You get it. I'm sorry, but like, you can't really expect your 15-month-old to really be doing a lot of stuff. You know what I mean?
They're practically a potato for the first year.
So it's so hard. And then, unfortunately, this is like when the MMR vaccine is given at 1 year of age and then at four. And in between that time, that's when kids do most of their development.
Their personality starts coming out.
They all these things. It's like that is what happens. So unfortunately, since it's two things, both things existing at the same time, they link it together. Mm-hmm. Okay. But you can't do that.
Okay. What is it? Correlation does not cause causation.
Causation, exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's literally the basis of all of this.
Yeah. But, you know. So Wakefield recommended giving children the vaccine separately rather than this whole entire MMR combination. Now, even though he never directly claimed that MMR causes autism, his wording strongly implied that there was a link. And guess what? The media ran with it.
Of course. Of course.
By now, knowing what we know, knowing how the gut works, mm-hmm. how much serotonin there is, and all these things with children that have autism spectrum disorder, maybe they do suffer a lot from gastrointestinal symptoms. Maybe there is a link with their with their neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. Okay, this has nothing to do with the MMR. It's so weird. Like, how did he just connect that? Like,
oh, we'll get
all of this started after their, you know, it's weird.
It's not as random as you think, guys. It's not as random as you're thinking. You'll see why.
Yeah. So now the study pretty much had a lot of problems, right? And let's just like name off of some of these, right? So a small sample size, okay? Like 12 kids. Come on.
That's just.
So you're going to make a harsh, like you're going to strongly word that everything came after the MMR vaccine and you just did 12 kids.
That was the total sample size. And then yet even less than 12 kids. Saw like
eight of the parents of those kids felt like it came after their vaccine.
So an even smaller size.
Yeah, an even smaller size. Exactly.
Okay.
There was no control group either. That is like that is literally, I don't even know how they could
say I wish I could have done studies without a control group. Shit. Yeah. Like,
so for those of you that don't know, a control group is basically the group that you do not
mess with. It's just like you're giving a blue pill to them with the actual medication to the study that you, the people. Okay, so blue pill medication, right? And then placebo, right? Placebo has nothing. Sugar and water.
Because you want to compare like how something progresses when you don't interfere with that group.
When you don't give that medication or whatever that is.
And you need that. You need that.
Because then you see if it actually is doing something or not.
If there's a difference or not.
It's that simple.
Yeah. So he had no control group.
Oh my God.
None. Subjective reporting. The data was based on parental recall. Which, come on, guys. Parental recall.
We're both mothers. I barely remember the first year of my son's life.
I don't know what Nora had for breakfast yesterday. I mean,
Bullshit!
Yeah.
I'm sorry. But no, like, I barely remember, and I hate that I don't. But it's true. There's so much going on. There's so much sleep deprivation. There's so much going on in the first year of his life. I barely remember what the hell happened.
Yeah, no, but hold on a second. This gets weirder, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, no gastroenterologist is going to do a lumbar puncture, okay? When you're a gastroenterologist, you're a GI doctor. Gastroenterology, okay?
The gut,
all right? From the mouth.
Your digestive system.
To the anus, okay? That's your thing. That's your jam.
That track.
Okay?
Not only that track. That track. It goes like, in one way, out the other.
But here we go. There were ethical concerns too. Wakefield performed invasive tests such as colonoscopies. Okay, fine. Gastroenterologist, right?
That's your field.
And lumbar punctures.
What?
Lumbar punctures? First of all, for what? So what? So now every kid that has an abdominal pain and has autism needs a lumbar puncture?
Okay, for those of you that don't know what a lumbar puncture is, what is it?
Yeah, so basically a lumbar puncture is when you, okay, you have your nervous system, right? Which is your brain and your spinal cord. There is a fluid that circulates.
Cerebrospinal fluid.
Yeah, cerebrospinal fluid, right? Cerebral, brain, spinal, your spine, right? It's a fluid that circulates and it moves, right? So a lumbar puncture is when you stick a needle, usually in the spine, and you cross multiple levels to get to that cerebral spinal fluid.
It's in your spine, in your column.
Yeah, it is in your central nervous system, like in that area, okay? So he performed on these kids lumbar punctures without even ethical approval. Why? How can someone please tell me why you would believe someone that if a kid with autism came with GI issues, okay, fine, scope them, bro.
Right.
Yeah.
Colonoscopy.
GI issues. All of that stuff. Okay. Yeah. Maybe you even need an endoscopy.
That's what it's in.
You know? But why do you need lumbar puncture?
I have no words.
And then anytime that you do a study, you have to disclose if you have any associations, affiliations, or if you've been
married.
Okay.
This is the part, guys. This is the part.
So he did have some financial conflicts. Wakefield was paid over £400,000, okay, which is about $500,000, by lawyers who wanted to sue vaccine companies.
Done. I'm sorry, but any study, regardless of what this was, I don't care if this was about nuclear physics, mm-hmm, okay? Mm-hmm. If you come with that,
yeah,
just titled there somewhere in the study that it was financed by the company that wants to go against whatever it is that you're studying, immediately no.
Yeah.
To me, it's invalid.
Yeah. But again, people ran with the MMR
vaccine. Or at least look at it with like the precision of like a neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
That study. Like it better be the most comprehensive with the biggest sample size, the most like with the most resources.
But it didn't.
It was the opposite.
It was the opposite of that. Yeah. It was the opposite of that.
Follow the money, guys. Follow the money. And the money here is against the vaccine companies.
And you know what's crazy is that everyone's always like, oh, the media. But when it comes to vaccine hesitancy, I don't hear that. And I'm the person, I'm like, the media, social media, all these things are kind of circulating misinformation and all false claims. But nope, that has to be true.
Guys, I'm sorry, but this is why I thought that we should dive into deeply and dedicate a good portion of autism in this episode on this quack, because that's what he is, a freaking quack. I'm not going to give him another name for it.
He
was paid off.
And he's responsible. He's responsible for a lot of children that
for his greediness,
he died and will die
continually
from a vaccine preventable disease.
Because he got paid how much again? About 500K.
No, and he continues to get paid. This guy is still circulating and doing interviews.
Yeah.
Let's not pretend that he's like living miserably. No. He is out and about. Okay? Yeah,
unfortunately. So this is just, if you guys think about most people that are anti-vaccine and all that stuff, they really believe in conspiracy theories and all that. There's like some correlation to it, not entirely, but there is a little bit. Some of them do.
Yeah.
Guys, follow the money.
Yeah.
Don't you do that with like government shit, alien shit.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a doctor, so I could say all these things. Don't you like try to look for, oh, who's funding this? Who's doing that? But that's why this conspiracy is that, because of the money, this and this and that. Guys, follow the money here. Follow the money here. And I'll show you who's really the quack.
Yeah.
It's this freaking guy.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he did exactly what he got paid for. He did it.
Yep.
He fucking did it. And that was back, what was this, 98?
Yeah.
Back in 98. And we're still in 2025. And look, there's a Texas measles outbreak right now. Yeah. That doesn't need to exist.
Yeah.
Doesn't need to exist. But yep. because of this quack from 98, okay, it's existing.
Yeah.
And there's children and families suffering from it.
Yep.
And measles is not just your regular cough, guys. It's not. No. It's pretty fucking serious. And there's a whole freaking outbreak of it in Texas.
Yeah. And not only that, I feel like maybe some people are just like, you know, just like the measles, like, oh, what? Like the rash. And I've had a lot of people tell me, oh, yes. My family tells me that there's a ton of measles all the time in whatever European country they're talking about. However, you don't know what can happen, the sequela of measles. You can have something called measles encephalitis. And trust me, that is your worst fear. That is your worst fear for a parent, for your kids to have a measles encephalitis.
Encephalitis is what?
It's inflammation. Inflammation of the brain. Okay, inflammation of your brain. And you can have like permanent damage from this. If you don't die. As well. Yeah. Okay. So just like how people have meningitis, an infection of the brain, you can have like permanent damage from that. You can have that from a measles encephalitis. Okay. So it's not just measles. It's not just the rash, the red eyes, the cough, the coryza, the runny nose, okay? It's not just the terrible fevers that you can have from that.
Which will cause a problem on their own.
Yes, all of that can have complications.
Like okay? High fevers are an issue.
An issue, exactly. And you can have dehydration, like all these things. However, people are spoiled by survivor bias. Okay, I survived it, so you can survive it too.
All right, so having said that, so what is the aftermath of all of that? Kind of what we're living right now mm-hmm. in 2025. We're actively having a measles outbreak in Texas.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely ridiculous to me, to be honest, for something that we have a vaccine for. But anyway.
Yeah, and that area in Texas is like heavy, I think it's a Mennonite.
Exactly. Community. But the problem
is they're like infamous for like not vaccinating. Okay.
The problem is that if it starts somewhere, it spreads.
Yeah. Yes. This is.
It's a very, very contagious.
Contagious disease. Yeah.
So it's like, okay, I don't care. The fact is that it's here.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how it starts. Yeah. Look at COVID for fuck's sake. It started in China.
It's not just that, but like, what about pregnant people?
Yes. Like, immunocompromised.
That is.
Cancer patients. Like everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Hello.
Yeah.
Whatever. Anyway. So media hysteria after all of that. After Wakefield's claims, British newspapers ran sensational headlines about the quote unquote MMR autism link. Mm-hmm. Okay. So parents scared for their children delayed or refused vaccinations outright. Next, you have the decline in vaccination rates, which we are still seeing right now. The UK MMR vaccine rates dropped from 92% to 79% after the study. In Ireland, vaccination rates dropped so low that measles outbreaks surged, leading to hospitalizations and deaths. Kind of what we're seeing right now.
Yep.
Next, the one it tickles me so greatly in the worst way, celebrity influence. Wakefield claims gained support from celebrities like Jenny McCarthy. Don't even get me started on her and her bullshit.
But it's so crazy to me how people, the celebrity influence.
Like, who gives a fuck?
Yeah. A perfect example on this whole entire, like, vaccine hesitancy.
Yeah.
And, you know, Candace Owens.
No, wait. Maybe I do, but I don't know the
you
name.
You know her. You know
her. Yeah, I probably know.
She's the one that has the podcast and... here her you know her. Okay so Candace Owens doing a great job on the Blake Lively case, by the way. I will give credit where credit is due. Okay. However, she has this very famous podcast or kind of like a segment called Shot in the Dark. Okay. And it's basically, she starts off about like this whole entire like vaccine thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm listening to her and I'm like, what is this shot in the dark, right? And the way that she says it, it was like this person standing up in one of her conferences or whatever. And a person stands up and she's like, she's pregnant. She's like, hi, I'm pregnant. And oh, also, boy. And she immediately, Candace immediately points to the girl and she's like, shot in the dark. Did you hear that series? Shot in the dark. And then I'm like, what is that? I was like, what is shot in the dark or whatever? Yeah. So she hosted this whole entire series called Shot in the Dark, all about the vaccine hesitancy and theories and all of that, right? So she starts off, right? I'm like, I want to listen to what she has to say, right? I want to listen to this.
Well, I mean, it's in your field, so you, yeah.
Right, yeah. I want to, let me entertain this, right? So she starts off by saying, you know, I, listen to this. This is her words, okay? She's like, I grew up in a household, you know, very, you know, like, basically playing it that she grew up in a very poor family, right? And she's like, we were all vaccinated, okay? We were all vaccinated in my house, okay? And then she said, as she got older and that she left that whole entire, like, you know, maybe like poverty type of situation, and that she went to school and that she started associating herself with people of a higher class. This is all what she's saying. Okay. All what she's saying.
Okay.
She said, basically insinuating that she's, and she said this, she's like, oh, I mean, guys, I know celebrities that don't vaccinate their kids. And almost like, what the hell does that mean? Because you're a celebrity, all of a sudden you're smarter than a person that lives in the hood. Like, I don't.
What she's trying to imply is
that people
with money
are smarter than people, lower class people. Like, basically that the lower class has less education, so they don't ask questions when they go to their doctor and they just vaccinate. This is all her. This is not me. Okay. You guys can look this up. It's very public. It's on YouTube. Okay. So is the celebrity influence? How is it? Why did she just say that? Why did you just say, I have celebrity friends that don't vaccinate their kids? Who the fuck cares? All that tells me is that with all your money, okay,
you're still an idiot.
You're still a fucking idiot.
Yeah, you're an idiot.
Yeah. That's what it tells me. That's the only thing it tells me. And you're an idiot for assuming that, because just because someone grows up in a neighborhood, okay,
so you're telling,
doesn't mean that just because they went to the doctor that they just blindly was like, yeah, sure, give them all the shots that they need. No.
So you're a sheep.
Yeah.
You're a sheep.
That's exactly what she said.
So this you're a sheep said. Because you're following what these, who you aspire to be, who you look up to, you know, as these elite, rich people, whatever. So you're being a sheep.
Yeah.
And you're not questioning why they're not doing that, why they're idiotic.
She's just assuming that because they have money, they must be very educated. They must be making the right decisions on not vaccinating. Mm. That was the link there. That was the link.
Solid link.
And it's almost like, it's like through the screen. It's like, or it could be that these people are following the advice of a doctor that they have known for years. Uh-huh, okay. Uh-huh. And this comes from backed up research. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. But no, the lower class must be stupid. They must be, because, you know, they're vaccinated. They don't ask any questions.
This whole celebrity influence goes back to our last episode with Belle Gibson.
Yeah.
It's exactly that.
Yeah.
But in the vaccine world.
Yeah.
That's all it is, honestly. It's somebody that's charismatic, that has a lot of followers, that has a platform.
Yep.
Then they're like, this.
And I'm just like, wow. And the way that she proudly said that, she's like, shot in the dark. Did you watch that? Were you a part of Shot in the Dark? And I was like, this girl is really promoting it. Like, if she was a physician, like, if she's done research everything, it's crazy to me how people can be so full of themselves.
Yep.
Belle Gibson.
That's exactly it. That's how it perpetuates.
Yep. But keep on with your Blake Lively stuff. Money right there.
So why don't you stick to your lane?
Yeah, exactly. Stick to your lane. Like that, you know? Exactly. Stick to your lane, my love. Anyways, she has this whole entire like series now on Macron. Yeah. But anyways, okay.
Anyway, so as we were saying, the misinformation spread rapidly to the US and other countries. Absolutely, because it continues to do so. Global measles outbreak. So before 1998, measles had been nearly eliminated in several countries, guys. After the vaccine scare, measles came back and skyrocketed because that's what viruses do.
Yeah.
In 2019, there were over 207,500 measles deaths globally. So there's deaths.
Yeah.
As we were saying, many of which could have been prevented by vaccines. By that shot in the dark.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk a little bit on how science fought back, or as we are trying to fight back. Because Lord knows I am fighting that good fight every day.
You do every day.
Every single day.
Jesus.
Multiple times a day. Anyways. Just things have come into my mind. Okay. So in 2004, that's when the investigation actually began, So the British journalist Brian Deer investigated the Wakefield study, And he found all those ethical violations. How did The Lancet not do this already? Do you know, like, just to publish a case report?
That's what I'm saying.
I had to jump through hoops.
Everybody
to
does.
To do that.
Everybody does.
The I had to jump through hoops
the amount
to write
data,
up a case report.
It's just...
So here comes this guy. Thank you, Brian. Okay. Deer revealed that Wakefield was paid by lowers. They were lower people. Lawyers. Lawyers who wanted to sue vaccine manufacturers.
Jesus.
Okay.
This now, is real journalism at work.
Yes. Okay. So the children in the study were recruited through the anti-vaccine activists.
So...
Hold on. Weren't even patients of his.
That's what I wanted you to get to.
Yeah.
That these 12 people, on top of it being a small sample study, they were also recruited.
Yeah.
So there were biases.
Yeah.
Multiple Guys, biases. This is not random 12 autistic kids. These were recruited.
Yes.
So they have biases. This is against everything that you do for a case, for any type of study.
Yep. Yep.
Continue. I'm sorry.
So that was in 2004.
This is just like every time I go over this, it enrages me because of all the vaccine hesitancy has gone into people's minds.
No, and now it's just not MMR vaccine, by the way.
No, it's everything. Now,
this has trickled over to every vaccine.
To everything. Of like it's even gone into the minds of people that used to believe in vaccines. Now they question it because of all of this bullshit that's out there. And it drives me up the wall. I don't know how you do this on a daily basis. Like, it's wow. Wow, wow, wow.
And sometimes, you know, just yesterday, literally just yesterday. Because guys, I am fighting that fight.
Every day.
Every day. Just yesterday, I had a family member come in with their child, And I said, hey, they are 2 months old. It's time, like per recommendation, it's time that they get blah, 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 blah vaccines, And their response was, well, my partner just doesn't feel good about this vaccine. And I'm like, well, which vaccine was that? Mm-hmm. And they said, I can't remember.
Awesome.
And I'm like,
What do you want me to do with that?
So I saw him. I'm like, well, let's go through each and every vaccine, the disease, and the complications of it. I went through everything. And then even then, she was like, I need to talk to my husband. Sure. Talk to your husband. Mm-hmm. Tell me why. She came back and she was like, what were those vaccines again? And I'm like, ma'am, so you came in here today for your 2-month-old well child check, And I'm very good at, from your previous checkup, I'm already talking about your next checkup. Mm-hmm. So at the 1-month checkup, because I do 1-month checkups, at the 1-month checkup, I'm like, hey, I'll see you in a month. And at that time, it's going to be first the other round of shots, And I tell him, it's going to be these shots. I literally have, a CDC schedule so that I can show them, take a picture of it, do your research. I can provide the vaccine forms, everything. No. So I'm just, it's just puzzling to me how But again, sometimes I kind of just ground myself and I tell myself it's that these people live in a world where it's just their world and they don't really see the complications of these things.
Yeah.
And it's really sad, but unfortunately, they don't understand that until it hits close to home for them.
Right. Yeah, no.
Someone dies or someone that they know, their child dies or something.
Or and then that, like something.
That's when they're like, we need to go to the doctor. Do they have these vaccines? And it's like, what? But anyways, okay, sorry, guys. I'm just going on a tangent. I'm like on an emotional tangent. I mean... All right. So, okay. So that was 2004. In 2010, The Lancet actually retracted the study. Wow. It only took how many years?
It was 12?
12 years. Okay. So after a 12-year investigation, The Lancet fully retracted. So, okay, guys, that's another thing that I wanted. They're like, oh, yeah, because I have people that are like, yeah, of course they're going to retract it. It got so much negativity. They just wanted to cover, you know, CYA, cover your ass. And I'm like, no, it was way after, like, 12 years. That was a good enough time of investigation for them to finally be like, we got to retract the study.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So The Lancet fully retracted the Wakefield study, stating that it was fundamentally flawed. Sorry, Lancet, but y'all effed up on this one.
Yeah.
And you should have not published that from the beginning. So I actually do feel like they were a little bit at fault
this. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And not only that, not only that it wasn't like flawed, but it was basically had no scientific validity. Okay. The retraction was a rare and serious move. Okay. It is rare. It is rare for something to be published and then removed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Indicating how deeply flawed the research was. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He manipulated numbers.
Yes. So I like this quote, and I forgot the name of the person that said this, but anyways, the quote goes like this: science doesn't care if you believe it or not.
Correct.
Okay. It is proven,
mm-hmm.
okay? Mm-hmm. It is always going to prove, right? Because it's science. That's the basis of it.
If not, it would be a religion.
It's theory that goes through studies, and it is proven, okay? So it does not care if you believe in it or not. These are the facts, okay? And this guy's study was completely retracted.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that people didn't like his study. Mm-mm. It's the fact that it was severely flawed. And unfortunately published.
It was just wrong.
And it was a mistake. Yeah, it was a mistake. And that same year, Wakefield loses his medical license. Good. I'm happy it didn't take 12 years for that to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Well, actually, it did take 12 years. But between when it, like, was redacted.
Right.
So the General Medical Council, the GMC, founded Wakefield guilty of dishonesty, unethical behavior, and scientific misconduct. And he was stripped of his medical license and banned from practicing medicine in the UK. Okay.
Good.
Yep.
But unfortunately, he's still out there spreading his word. So let's go ahead and do the opposite of what he did, right?
Yeah.
So there's large scale studies that prove that there is no link between vaccines and autism, right? So exactly. The polar opposite of what he did.
Yeah. And that's actually something I'm happy that you're going to jump into. Okay. It's literally the opposite so that people can see.
Yeah.
But that's another thing that I tell my patients. I'm like, if this was something that was actually linked, you don't think that anyone else in this world would have come up with something similar?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But anyways. All right.
Mm-hmm. All right. So since Wakefield's fraudulent study, multiple large-scale studies have debunked the vaccine autism myth. In 2002, a Danish study of 537,000 children, not 12, okay? Researchers studied, I'm going to say it again, 537,000 children.
Not 12.
And found zero difference in autism rates between vaccinated and unvaccinated children. In 2010, 1.8 million children across multiple countries, not just in Denmark, okay? Not 12. A meta-analysis of 1.8 million children found no connection between MMR and autism. And then in 2019, another Danish study, this time of 650,000 children for over 10 years. Now we're making it a little different in the fact that we're spanning it, right? Because then you have some people who are like, oh, it's only in that moment. What about later? let's span that across 10 years, found no increased autism risk with MMR.
Yep.
So there you go. And but yet we're going to go ahead and listen to the quack with the 12 children that were picked.
Yeah, picked, and he was paid for. And the 12 children were picked by the group that paid him.
Yeah, that sounds more valid to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Despite the facts, the vaccine myth just won't fucking die, okay? Because there's no other way of saying it. So even though the entire scientific community had debunked the myth, many people still believe it, largely due to misinformation and spread online and through the media.
And so, also, it's like that connection, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, okay, God forbid something happens to my kid, right? I'm going to strip the earth to figure out why. Why did that happen? Again, what is the reason? I want to see it. Okay.
Exactly. It's a biological thing.
So this gave parents that. Okay. This gave them that thing like, this is it. Like, oh my God, this was it. Okay.
We just haven't found it yet, guys. We're getting close to it. There's some things that we could be like, yeah, maybe it's that. But it is in vaccines though.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It isn't. And we briefly touched upon it. We're going to go a little bit deeper in it, like when we said about genes and whatnot. It's just not vaccines.
Yeah.
Guys, there are other things.
Yep.
Okay. Social media has allowed anti-vaccine groups to thrive despite overwhelming scientific evidence against them. In other words, Wakefield was a fraud. Vaccines are safe and autism seems like it's genetic, according to the latest studies. Yeah. So I think that's a good place to end part one. I thought that it was wise for us to go deeply into that because it's
Jules and I have been avoiding it because it's very, again, polarizing. And we were kind of just like, our podcast isn't really about, you know, like one way or the other.
Yeah.
However, it was really important.
But this is one way or the other. This is black and white.
Black and white. Exactly.
Vaccines, do they cause autism or not? That is black and white.
Yeah.
Look at, and these are just three out of so many studies.
We have more studies showing the truth that there is no link.
Versus this
one study.
That was flawed.
Yeah.
And was fabricated.
Yeah.
So that's black and white, guys.
Yeah.
That's black. We're not talking about politics or anything like that. We're talking pure empirical evidence.
Yeah.
Is what we just said about vaccines and this quack. Because I'm not going to find anything other than a quack.
Yeah. So
let's go back to autism.
Yeah. Back to autism. To kind of wrap up our first part of this episode, we're going to talk a little bit on what is the presentation of it. Okay. So it's not obviously going to look the same. Every kid is going to be different.
Hence the spectrum.
Every person is going to be different. Hence the spectrum. Now, we did kind of touch upon this at the beginning of the episode, that social communication, and a little bit more on the specifics. Eye contact, small talk, sarcasm, maybe showing some sort of emotion somewhere in there. Literal thinking. So it's raining cats and dogs might be taking literal. So it's that connection that they're not making. That's part of interpreting that communication.
Yeah.
Delayed developmental milestones. That could be speech, that could be gross motor, that could be fine motor, that could be social, that could be problem solving. Those are like kind of the big domains that we look at, basically developmental delay. And then obviously a preference to be in their own thing, their own world, solitude. They just thrive better in that environment than to be in another group and maybe something that pushes them outside of their comfort zone.
There's that. And then there's also, I feel like they're so, everything's overemphasized in their brain.
Yeah.
Like, you know, their senses and all that, like their hearing, their visual, like visual perceptions and all that, that maybe the solitude is a lot more, it's just calmer to take everything in, you know? Yeah.
So, and just when we were talking about the synapses and the neurotransmitters and everything, I like was diving deep into that. And I'm just like,
it's just a lot.
It's a lot.
Of course you're going to want to like just isolate yourself and get away from loud noises, lots of people, like things going around, like too much stimulus.
Exactly. Know? It's too much. Yep. Repetitive behaviors or special interests. So a lot of those repetitive behaviors are like auto-stimulation. So stimming kind, which means kind of like a self-regulation, self-simulatory behavior, which this is going to be the hand flapping, the rocking, spinning, walking around in circles or back to front, back to front. Mm-hmm. Echolalia is a big one. So echolalia is basically like repeating something. Mm. When you say stop that, and they're going to say stop that, they're going to repeat it back to you. It kind of helps regulate those emotions. Okay. So something triggers it. That's why I was saying, like, I try to ask those questions in a different way. Like, if they're angry, what do they do? Right. Do they have something that they kind of calms them down? Or you're kind of just like, oh no, they're doing that again. Okay. So those are the type of things that I kind of look out for. Routines and rituals. Changing that routine can be like very upsetting to them.
Yeah.
So, well, no, this is not how this goes. Or I have someone that aligns something. All their things need to be in a certain way. And if someone comes and even just messes with it, triggers them.
It's like an OCD type of
thing. Like an OCD type of thing. Hyperfixation on interest. So some people with autism can kind of like deep dive into something that they really enjoy. Memorizing things, hobbies in certain things, an obsession with, I don't know, numbers.
Exactly. Okay? Yeah.
That's kind of like a hyperfixation. Mm-hmm. And then a strong preference for rules. And what I mean by that is like structure.
Yeah.
They like structure, logic. Well, no, we can't do this because this has to happen. It's kind of like that's how their brain works. They have to have like a process and a step for everything. And if they miss a step, it's kind of like, wait a minute. No, we have to do this before we move on to the next step.
Right.
Okay. And then sensory sensitivities, which we kind of talked about. So hypersensitivity, sounds, okay, can be really overwhelming a lot. Now they have those canopies. Have you seen those canopies?
Yes.
Which
yes.
is great. Yes. Okay. You kind of go in that canopy and you kind of escape from the world.
I don't want one. Shit.
Right?
I would love to put one.
I know.
Maybe I'll put one in here.
Hyposensitivity is another one. So some seek out like other sensory input, and then taste and smell. That's what kind of we were talking about, like when we see a lot of pickiness when it comes to foods.
Yeah.
Now, another thing that we didn't talk about is the gender. Autism tends to swing more in boys than in girls. So autism is actually 4 times more common in boys than in girls.
Okay.
Another thing about the vaccines. It's like...
Yeah, that wasn't...
Yeah. Why?
Right.
If it's the vaccine that causes it, why would it lean more to males than females?
And why would it
and
be
someone's
more...
going to be there, oh, because you know it affects this... No.
What about what we said earlier, even before the studies, the twins?
Yeah, exactly.
The familiar hereditary of it all?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Whatever.
Now, autism in girls can kind of have like mass traits. So like they copy social behaviors and try to like blend in, which can obviously delay a diagnosis. Now, how common is autism? So the prevalence estimates 1 in every 36 kids, which is a lot.
It's a lot.
It is a lot. But remember, prevalence, it's like all the existing ones in a time.
And the spectrum.
Yeah, exactly. And the spectrum. Exactly.
They all look very different.
Very different, but it's 1 in every 36. Okay. In the US, based on the 2020 data from the CDC's Autism and Developmental Disability Monitoring Network. And then a significant increase from 1 in 50 in the 2000s. Okay.
1 in 150.
Sorry. Not 1 in 50. 1 in 150.
There you go.
Thank you. Now, globally, the WHO, the World Health Organization, estimates about 1% of children have autism, with variations across studies and regions, potentially higher in low and middle income countries due to the underdiagnosis. Mm-hmm. Now, autism is diagnosed more frequently in males. Again, that 4-to-1 mm-hmm. ratio that we just talked about. However, recent research suggests that underdiagnosis in females could actually be one of the reasons why it's mostly diagnosed in males, which is interesting.
It is. It is.
Yeah. Now, there's also a surprising 450% increase in the diagnosis among young adults, okay, ages 26 to 34 from 2011 to 2022, as reported in a 2024 study that basically came from the autism diagnosis rising among U.S. children, and it was published on U.S. News. And again, but maybe these were the people that were missed.
Exactly.
You know, it's not just like they like now all randomly, of a sudden started having like symptoms that are consistent with that, you know?
Exactly. Again, it's a spectrum, guys.
Yeah.
That's the thing. If you weren't diagnosed before, you may get diagnosed later.
Yep.
So.
Exactly.
Not like it wasn't there before.
Exactly.
It probably was.
But just people didn't diagnose you.
Now, as you're an adult.
And it kind of sucks. Maybe you could have had some help with different things, and maybe that would have changed your life. Maybe that would have changed the way that you have relationships with other people, absolutely, the way you solve problems, the way you study, the way you go around your day to day.
And that's one of the positive things of social media, is that you see people having like, oh, I just got diagnosed at this age in adulthood with autism. And then you see their lives, you follow them, whatever. And then you see, wait a minute, I should probably get and see if I fall under the spectrum.
Yeah.
And then they get, you know, maybe they do, maybe they don't.
Yeah.
And that's how these things happen. Yeah. They're like, that is very reminiscent of me. I also do that, or I also feel like that, or whatever.
Or maybe you probably had maybe an idea, mm-hmm, and you were just too scared to do it.
Yeah. Or your parents just didn't mind to it. Or again, the social biases of our parents when we were kids.
And the denial.
Very different from now.
And the denial in some parents.
Big time.
Yeah.
Again, very different from what
it is now. And denial in some people.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. And again, that's why it's so abstract and so hard to diagnose. Because it's not something that you could just look at a scan or a blood work or something like that and it'll present itself.
Exactly.
So that's part one, guys.
Yes. That was a big part one.
Like I said, it's a big, 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 big topic. But stay tuned for the next one. It's going to get even more interesting.
Yeah.
And we will end it there with that one. But follow us on all forms of social media. Thank you guys for everything. But yes, we are in all forms of social media. We also have our email, funnymedicine305@gmail.com. And thank you guys for just commenting, liking, sharing, doing everything it is that you do, and all your love and support. And we'll see you on the next one.
See you on the next one. Bye. Bye.
Like, comment, review us on all streaming platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, etc.
Check us out on Instagram and TikTok at Funny Medicine Podcast. Our Gmail is funnymedicine305@gmail.com. And remember, we are not diagnosing you.
Definitely not. Just funny stuff.
See you later, guys.